A lot of the qualities that we associate with the human soul seem to be impaired when there's brain damage, brain injury. We can think of someone in a partially vegetative state or whatever. Mm-hmm. Should we get away from the idea that this person doesn't have a soul anymore, doesn't fully bear the image of God? If our soulishness is God choosing to be in relationship with us, mm-hmm. can't we say that even this person who doesn't look responsive, if we as members of Christ's body value that person, love that person, embrace that person, that God through us is in relationship with them? What would you say to something like that?
Well, I think that's a very important point, and Warren Brown writes about that in that one article I referenced, and he talks about what happens when we lose some of those capacities. And he says that indeed we have to maintain that relationship with them. It's always been a lopsided relationship. We were created to have reciprocal relationships with God and with one another, but when it's lost, then it's our duty to sort of maintain that for them, both humanly, but also understand that in terms of God's relationship with them, that they remain special despite that drastic loss. Also, D. Gareth Jones, he's an Australian neuropsychologist, has said we need to talk about the partial death of the person, that it's not a complete thing, but that person that we had with us is not here in totality. And I think that's important to understand, that that's a person, but it's not the same person, at least in this life, that we had before. I've talked with family members who, one woman, she struggled for years with her relationship with her mother, only to find out much later on that her mother had had a serious brain injury. And I talked to her for a long time about something, some things that had transpired, and I said, this was not your original mother. This was not the same person you had. And that was very therapeutic for her to understand that.
Now, your questions. Okay.
Thanks. That was fascinating and a little scary.
Yeah.
My question
wear
is
a
actually,
helmet from now on.
Yeah. My question is actually related in part to Dan's. I just wonder about how this theory then sort of accounts for people over time. So my five-year-old self is very different than my current self, mm-hmm. which is very different, presumably, from perhaps the self who will get Alzheimer's later in life, may or may not. And then related to that, to think about then maybe back to Paul's question about what is resurrected. Is it the five-year-old self? Is it me? Mm-hmm. With someone with brain damage, is it the person after brain damage who's resurrected? I mean, so how do we relate all this together?
I hope it's my five-year-old self, because I was really great as a five-year-old. So I had childlike faith. So I think, honestly, I don't know the answer to that question about what that resurrection body looks like. What is quite clear, both scripturally and I think in understanding both this world and the next, there's this continuity. You remember your five-year-old self. And that's one of the things I didn't have time to talk about, is our autobiographical memory, how important that is in projecting and understanding yourself over time. And even the changes of yourself over time are very, very important. And that's why memory loss is such a devastating illness, because you lose that personhood. That's a lot of what you are as a person, is your projection of yourself, not only in the past, but also thinking about yourself in the future. There's some fascinating research on areas of the brain that are involved in projecting ourselves into the future. We do this quite regularly. Not only the frontal lobes, but other areas are involved in that. And so I think whatever the answer is, there's a continuity, even though there's change. And that's the delightful thing. It's both dynamic, but also continuous. And I think we can project that into the next life.
Paul, John Polkinghorne has an interesting idea about the soul. I'd like to hear your reaction to it. He says, if you look at our bodies, the individual molecules and atoms in here are always changing. 5 years from now, there's probably going to be very, very few atoms that are the same as they're in my body right now. And yet, I'm very much aware of being the same person. Mm-hmm. So he says, from that, it's clear that we're not the same as our bodies. And he says, well, what is the same? Or he says, what carries over is the structure or the pattern in which those mm-hmm. things are organized. Mm-hmm. Now, that's an abstraction, and that could be remembered in the mind of God. and presumably then reincarnated in another body at some future time. Mm-hmm. And so that's what he identifies with the soul. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I would agree with that statement. I'm not... Polkinghorne's not so much a neuroscientist, so, you know, I think he's got a few things wrong there, but I would agree with him primarily on that. My students often ask, how and where is memory stored? And the answer is everywhere, and we don't have a clue. There was a lot of effort for a long time to find what was called the engram, the storage unit of memory, like it was in a little molecule or it was in one nerve cell or a certain chemical that you could maybe implant later on. My students asked that too. Is there a way that I can actually learn this class by just taking an injection? I said, we're not there yet. And I think we'll never be there because it's not found in a chemical. It's found in the organization. It's in the way a whole network of cells works. And that same network actually works with a bunch of other networks to have other memories. So it's the organization that counts. It's the complexity that really gives rise to mental activity and to memory as well. So it's not stored in a chemical. It's not stored in any one entity. It's stored in a whole unit that works together. And that's why I think, in some respects, he's correct that the molecules are changing. That's why our memory can remain, even though the molecules are always being changed, and because it's not found in a molecule. So I hope that answers it.
So carrying on from that, he also talks about, maybe this is connected really directly, and so maybe I'm going to sound silly, but this dual aspect monism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit, because I'm a person who doesn't like either ors.
Yeah.
You only gave us two.
Yeah,
you know?
I know.
So what about this dual aspect monism as a way of integrating?
Okay. If you're not familiar with dual aspect monism, it's basically, in essence, we're one thing, but there's two dimensions, if you will, two aspects. I'm totally fine with that. I don't know what that means. But if you like that language better, I'm all for it. Because there is a dimension, and I can't explain it. Of course, I can't explain in the traditional view how a soul would talk to a brain or a spirit or anything else like that. So it's just as mysterious. How on earth does consciousness arise out of stuff is the deepest mystery, and if you can explain it, you'll win a Nobel Prize, I'm pretty sure. And maybe it's never explainable. So you're right. The language system that we use to try and capture this, I don't know. I'm fine with dual aspect monism, and if that's what is sort of transformed, I'm not sure. I don't worry about it too much, but I think that's a good point.
What dies when we die, or what doesn't die?
I knew I shouldn't have gone into biblical studies on this at all. And I knew I should have taken my dad along. He would help me a lot with this. The best I can do is what Scripture says about the seed. I think, obviously, the physical entity that we are is no more, and that it's transformed. But there's also continuity, and so there's all kinds of evidence, stories, other than the one I read, about people remembering their existence, knowing other people. These are referred to regularly. And so, as to what dies, the person dies, but is transformed and continued. That's the best I can do, because I think it's all of one still. And so I think to say, well, just the body dies, well, no, it's the person in total.
I'm not sure I'll get this out right, but I'll try. You talked about a couple of examples of injuries that dramatically changed someone's accessibility to his emotions. Mm-hmm. And I think I inferred from some of that also that may very much affect their ability to believe in God.
Right.
Are there studies on not injuries, but, you know, kind of the range of people, you know, more normal people?
Mm-hmm.
And can we translate that into a difference in a person's ability or at least orientation toward believing in his faith?
You raised some really great questions. One of the things I talk about with my students is this whole idea of constraints and free will. Can I freely choose God? If I have a brain injury that constrains me, what does that mean? I like to tell my students that brains constrain you, they don't cause you. I know that's maybe hard to wrap your mind around that as well, but I like to tell them that I might limit my perceptions, it might limit my actions, it might limit what I can think about, but it does not cause me to act a specific way very often. And so what will means is hard to say. I know Warren Brown and I have long discussions about this, and he says we shouldn't talk about a will as if it's a thing, but we are willful. We act willfully within the constraints that we have. There have been studies, in fact, showing that there's a wide variety of ranges. Brain structure has been related to political ideology, to religious orientation, to a variety of things that you wouldn't think would have anything to do with brain structures. But in fact, there's a continuum of this. But does that mean that you said, now God in the last day will say, well, your brain structure wasn't such that you would easily believe in me, therefore you're off the hook? I don't think so. But I'm a Calvinist, so it's okay. Yes, Al.
You had a lot of really interesting information, and with respect to monism versus dualism, I guess I'd say I wouldn't call it compelling, as you said. I'd say maybe more suggestive. But I wanted to ask you about what Steven Pinker said about the afterlife, and somebody else also mentioned the afterlife. He seemed to think that the notion of an afterlife is somehow involved intimately with dualism, and when you give that up, you also give up the notion of an afterlife. And I wonder if there isn't something to that. I mean, if you consider Paul saying that he would much rather be absent from the body and present with the Lord, you know, but he can't because he's needed here, his people need him, and so on. So he can't be, but he would much rather be. So he seems to be suggesting that he's not just a physical organism, he is something that can be absent from his body. And then also when you think about our dying, you know, when we die, we rise again, but it might be a while from now. So maybe I die, and maybe my body completely decomposes, all the atoms get distributed, maybe they form other people's bodies and so on, some of them do. But still, I come back, I acquire a body again later on. And it can't be really that I just go completely out of existence. It's not like for a while I exist, then I don't exist, and then later on I do again. That doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. It seems that I've got to be there when my body isn't. Now, one way around this is what you said Martin Luther suggested, namely, and Peter Van Inwagen makes the same kind of suggestion, maybe when you die, God takes your body immediately away and replaces it by a simulacrum, which is a thing that decays and so on. But that seems sort of very implausible. And I'm just wondering how you think about that, then, about how you think about what Paul says and how you think about what goes on between the time you die and when your body, when there's a resurrection of the body.
Well, I told myself in advance, if Al Planning asks a question about this, you're the last person I'm going to debate about the intermediate state, so I'm not even going to go there. I think about it a lot. I mean, and I don't have ready answers for you, and that verse is certainly one of the favorite dualist passages of Paul writing about being out of the body and being with Christ. Clearly, you know, that, at least on the surface, presents problems. Many people have grappled with that, suggesting, well, he's talking about being in the flesh, being in the present existence is what he's referring to, not necessarily being away from, being split apart somehow. But so that's how some people have interpreted it. I'm not enough of a biblical scholar to say if they have it right or not. So people have dealt with that passage. I do want to retain the idea of resurrection. But I think it's important to remember that the Christian religion is the only religion that really stresses that resurrection of the body. And I've often pondered, and maybe I'm being simplistic, but why? If we're doing fine in heaven without it, what's the point? I mean, what? I mean, I'm not asking a scriptural question. I'm just asking a 10-year-old question, like, Sunday school teacher, why is it that we have a body then? It's a naive question, but it's something I ponder. You know, if we're doing fine without it, what's the point? And if we were created with bodies to begin with, wouldn't that be important to continue that? So, again, I don't have direct scriptural response, but these are just sort of the philosophical musings that I have in response to that, saying, well, it seems to me that the bodies are very important, and that's continued throughout. Again, the intermediate state, I'm actually not opposed to the idea, or even the separation for that matter. I'm just not sure it's necessary, is my response.
A little different question. The gentleman that had frontal cortex damage reminded me of something I've always wondered about, and that is animals sometimes seem to be so totally unsympathetic to each other. You have the wolves that eat the moose before it's dead, and you have the cat that plays with the mouse. And is there something there in the brain structure that's different, or do you have any comment about that?
They have pathetic frontal lobes. I can tell you from experience, I've done a lot of mouse work, actually, and I can't hardly find the frontal lobe sometimes. It's that bad, because I'm doing some mouse work in the summers recently, and we're doing some stimulation of brain cells, and in the literature they say, make sure you're in the frontal lobes. I'm not even sure where the frontal lobe is. So it's much degraded, obviously, in that group. And indeed, that's a problem. I mean, that's part of it. Now, they do emotionally regulate, and they have, higher organisms. Apes have quite a bit of empathy for one another. They actually show a fair amount. Most animals have empathy for their children. They'll respond to that. Although, as Darwin said, when a bird wants to fly south for the winter, it agonizes over leaving a baby behind, but eventually it will, and then the guilt will just vanish. So there is empathy, but it doesn't last. Maybe because they don't have a good memory system. So you're right that there's clear qualitative differences, and that is part of that relationality. Those things are very important qualities that you wouldn't have without the kind of bodies that we have.
In the first part of your talk, you set up monism and talked about how it's a better explanation from a cognitive or a mm-hmm. processing mm-hmm. Standpoint. And then the second part, and this struck me, that you also talked about the emotional and the rational brain and the need for and the, in fact, the uniqueness of the integration of those two, and that's part of what makes us human. Mm-hmm. And then I really like the quote from Elizabeth Lewis Hall about, embodiment and being integrated not just within our brains, but with each other. Mm-hmm. And I was struck by the connection to our two prior speakers, because there was much made of the relational nature of God and the relational nature of humans. Mm-hmm. And I asked a question previously, and put a little finer point on it, is our history as dualists and rationalists and materialists, does that get in the way of Westerners coming to a full appreciation of God? Is a monist belief more compatible globally with Christianity?
I think those are some wonderful questions. I know my colleague Warren Brown has actually spoken at Fuller on the impact even of a dualist notion on worship, that we spiritualize, which he's not opposed. God is spirit, so he's not an anti-spiritualist, but he says that we focus so much on the dimension this way, we forget about the dimension this way. We don't sort of have an integrated connection, and we lose that horizontal connection a great deal. And he says even the way we design our worship, we all face forward, we're not looking at each other, we're not communing with one another, and I think he has got some really valid points. So I think in Western society we have downplayed the material so much that becomes sort of irrelevant. This world is not my home, I'm just a passing through, so who cares about any of it, including science and psychology? Well, all that's going to be washed away. But I think it has real value to work on this life as well.
I have two questions. First was that clip about the man who couldn't see anything in his right vision, but he could draw it with his, he was drawing it with his left hand. Was he left-handed originally, or was he only able to use his left hand because it was in the right field of vision?
Right. He's using his left hand, but you notice it was a poor quality drawing, and he even had trouble recognizing his own drawing because he's not left-handed.
Okay.
He was able to make some reasonable facsimile of it, so he's aware of, in his right brain, he knows it's a phone or a pan or whatever the word was, but when he draws it, then, of course, his vision can move around, and he can move it, move his eyes accordingly and get that information to both sides of his brain, and there he then can inform the other side, so to speak.
Okay. Then my other question is, I've worked in the past with students with learning disabilities, and there is a whole body of thought that says differently abled, strengths in certain areas that are weaknesses for other people and so on. So that leads me to think about the new heaven and the new earth and as new creatures. So take someone with bipolar disorder. You know, the highs are wonderful and they're creative and so on. And so what kind of a new person, new creature, might a person with bipolar disorder be?
Well, my response to is only to quote the song, I Can Only Imagine. There's a wonderful song about that, and I guess that's my best response. I'll suggest that we have continuity. So there'll be some continuousness to us. Physically, we'll have some appearance, at least that's what Scripture seems to suggest, and that we will have a continuity of thought and mind. Now, I hope my worst traits are gone. But now I don't know what that really even means. Maybe they're not my worst traits, I just use them bad. You know, I talk about obsessive compulsive disorder in my classes, but my wife is a nurse and I kid her about being a little OCD. That's a good thing. I want my nurse to check the medication 3 times. Is that a disorder or is that a great quality? Maybe it depends on the context. And so I think perhaps maybe our worst characteristics will be our best. And I could envision that a disorder that we think is a disorder will actually be used to God's glory in some other way, and we'll actually celebrate it.
Let's have one more question.
When you were talking about the loss of being able to recognize what a shoulder shrug means and things like that, I came to mind some kids that I work with that are Asperger's or on the autism spectrum. Is there studies done relating that to this area of the brain?
That's actually some of the parts I skipped. I can show you this picture. This picture shows on the one side an intact corpus callosum. You know, I showed you that. On the right is a child with no corpus callosum, born that way from birth. This is a condition called agenesis of the corpus callosum. It's a fairly rare condition, but colleagues and I have studied this group. A lot of them have Asperger's-like symptoms. And one of the difficulties we think they have is they not only don't connect modules from left and right, but also front to back. So they have all the modules, but they can't relate them. They can't join them. This actually extends my metaphor a little further, I think. It's sort of like a dysfunctional church. You know, lots of parts, they all know what they're doing, but they don't join together, and therefore they're all kind of lost. And so I think one of the reasons those individuals can't judge the shrug of a shoulder is they actually do judge it. Their brain responds, but they don't connect it to anything. And so they don't know how to respond to it. And so there's a lot of evidence that people with Asperger's have sort of what we call disconnection syndromes. Some of the pathways that connect key areas for social functioning aren't there, or they're diminished. You can teach it with a lot of careful, you know, you can teach anything to anybody just about. I've been told you can teach a schizophrenic to drive, and they stop at a red light, even though they hear voices. Yeah, you can teach this, but it takes painstaking work. And you have to, what most of us catch automatically, they have to be taught to pay attention to carefully and respond to each and every little cue and learn to memorize, this is my appropriate response. So it takes painstaking effort, but yes, it can be done.
Paul, that was fascinating. Thank you so much. Please join me in thanking.
Thank you.